Hello and welcome to Wednesday. No? No. Okay. Hello and welcome to Wednesday. Does that work? No? Still not. It's on. Okay. All right. How's that? Now you can hear me? I've got it cranked up as far as it'll go. Okay. Hi. Business. We will have a review session after class a week from today. A week from today is the last lecture in this unit. This is the shortest unit. And so we have an exam a week from Monday. Holy smoke, how did that happen? But we will. And the review session after class a week from today will be in Fleming Museum 101. And you'd like other review sessions, maybe? Yes. So if you were going to have one on Thursday next week, would you like it the 2 o'clock? Raise your hand if I tickle your fancy. 2 o'clock? 3 o'clock? Thursday. 4 o'clock? 5 o'clock? 6 o'clock? 7 o'clock? 8 o'clock? 5 o'clock? 5 o'clock Thursday. Friday? Morning? Noon? 1, 2, 3, 4, this is Friday we're talking about. 5, 6, 7, 8, get alive, okay. I didn't see much enthusiasm for Friday. How about Saturday? Morning. Get a life, right? I can't do Saturday afternoon. How about Saturday night? Right. Get a new wife. Right. No, I can't do Saturday night either. How about Sunday afternoon? Sunday evening? Sunday evening, huh? Early? 6? 6, 7, 8, 5. I know how to count. I really do. They're times. I'm not counting things. Okay. It looks like 6 o'clock Sunday. No? How many of you said yes for 6 o'clock on Sunday? Was 7 better? No. Okay. I have to clear that with the powers that be to find out if I'm booked for Sunday at 6. But if you beg, maybe she'll let me out. We'll see. Of course, by that time in the weekend, she'll probably say, "Take him, take him. I don't want him anymore." In a friendly fashion. If you are taking the exam in the proctoring center, make sure that you are scheduled and let me know that you are and what time you are so I can have the exam there. We are scheduling study skills specific for this course, compliments of Talia, at 5 o'clock on Monday next week. That's after class. And we've requested a room in Living Learning. We don't have confirmation yet, but that's where we'll probably be. And at 2 o'clock on Wednesday. How many of you would come to 5 o'clock on Monday? 2 o'clock on Wednesday. Okay. If you haven't picked up your exam yet, Talia has them. And we will stop bringing them to class fairly soon. If the two people are here today who went to the office to pick them up during class on Monday, be aware that you gave the administrative assistants something to tease me about. Don't do that again. It looks bad. You say, well, your students were here, Larry, picking up your exam. Trying to, but it wasn't here. Okay, so just don't do that. What else do I have to do? The exam analysis writing exercise, the potential 8 points, is due Monday. And the exam is posted outside Living Learning C150 all day, every day. Today, tomorrow, Friday, possibly on Saturday, if I can't think of anything better to do than be at the office, possibly on Sunday. It will be up Sunday through the middle of the day because I have to be here anyway. People that I have talked to about the exam analysis are finding it somewhat interesting, and it's kind of a fun process. I'll just warn most of you that the most common problem on the multiple choice exams is that nobody believes the possibility that all of the above could be a real correct answer, but it was several times. And I'll just tell you a little bit about the psychology of that. When I write my own items, which I often do, I often use the exam as a way for you to review the concepts in addition to testing you on them. I think you should learn something. And so I often write questions that review a whole bunch of points on a particular topic, and the answers to those are occasionally, or more than occasionally, all of the above. So you can trust it. When three of them look right and the other one could be, All right. The other, no, that's all. Okay. I promised we would actually look at the exercises today. We will actually do that. The Piaget thing. And just to review briefly, this was the 5-minute version of Piaget's theory, and his point in all of the tasks that he assessed children in, his point was to look at what they have to know, what they do know, how that knowledge changes over time, and whether there's any consistency across those tasks. And it's a very complex career that he set out for himself, because he did spend 50 or 60 years looking at children of all ages and testing them on various tasks. And he describes in great detail the sorts of changes that kids go through on each task, and then what that represents across tasks and how kids are changing at different points as their brains change and they accumulate experience and knowledge that they can coordinate in more complex ways. But the foundation of that theory, the foundation of that theory, is that all of our knowledge begins with our sensory motor experience in the world. What we touch, what we do, it's action and vision and hearing that provide the basic data that become our knowledge. And then we add the ability to represent that, particularly in words, but in graphics as well, but particularly words. But you can't understand the meaning of a word unless you can connect it to features of the real world. And that's fairly evident with young children. And then as we get up to school age, we organize that knowledge more consistently because our brains allow us to look at more than one thing at a time and coordinate, and I'll give us some examples of that, the experience that we have and the concepts that we've developed. And then as we go through puberty, we typically begin to be able to deal with abstract organizational schemes and compare them and to think about them. But the unappreciated, radical, very radical concept in Piaget's theory is that everything you know and every skill you have developed in your thinking begins with and incorporates sensory motor knowledge. And you never stop acquiring knowledge through your sensory motor experience. So you're adding the abilities to represent that knowledge, but Piaget's radical notion was that all of our knowledge is based on our own experience of and in the world. And many of the intellectual operations that we go through, the things we do in our heads with our knowledge, are internalizations of external actions. And that's a really radical notion. And he really meant it. And I believe it. So when I talk about justice or a democratic system, the challenge is to think about what are the operations in the physical world that I'm using to understand justice or a democratic system or evolution. And most of us don't take that notion very seriously, but I recommend that you wrestle with that for the rest of your lives to understand how knowledge is developed. So I want to illustrate with some tasks and look at, for example, you love analogies, right? SAT time. Okay. Verbal fluency, verbal reasoning, typical task. The ones that I gave you, the three that I gave you, or four that I gave you, are from an English test by a guy named Lunzer who studied this. They're based on ones that Piaget did, but Lunzer developed his own task. And the question is, what makes the best analogy? And you all know what an analogy is. So tell me what you got and how you got it. Horn. How come? Okay. So a bell is an accessory after the crime of bicycle. And horn is an accessory after the crime of... No, I'm sorry. It's an accessory on. And is it a particular kind of accessory? It makes noise. What's the noise for? Alerting. Okay. It's an auditory warning device. So why isn't it wheel? Cars have wheels, bicycles have wheels. Why would a kid tell me that wheel was the right answer? And they do. Yep. And did you know that bells, I have one really great 8-year-old, he also, when he explained it, well, they all have wheels. Bicycles have wheels, bells have wheels, and cars have wheels. So wheel is the common element in all three of those. Okay. Is he wrong? Can you think of a bell that has a wheel? Sure, which one? The bell in the steeple that you pull the rope is wrapped around the bell wheel. It's also called a pulley, but it's not a pulley in that case. It's the bell wheel. This kid, nice church-going kid, big thrill in his life, as it was in mine as a child, was to ring the church bell. And if you grab the rope high enough and pull it down, have you ever done that? The weight of the bell, if it's big enough, will pull you off the floor. It's a great action. Okay, so this kid knew that. The problem is that it's not an analogy. What he's discovering and what he's claiming is that wheel is the right answer because it is the common element across the other three concepts, which is a reasonable task. We often ask kids, what's the common element? How are these all alike? But it's not an analogy. So he gives me the wrong answer. Why would a kid say engine? How many of you said engine? Yeah, three of you did, and you won't admit it. So why would a kid say engine is the right answer? It makes noise. Cars have engines, and bicycles don't. So it's the defining characteristic of the major difference between the car and the bicycle. We also ask kids often, how are these different? And they know that. They know that cars have engines and bicycles don't. So they tell me the engine is the right answer, and they'll defend that. And they'll say, exactly, cars have engines and bicycles don't. Problem is, it's not an analogy. It's the defining difference. Why would a kid say hoot? They rarely do. But occasionally an 8 or 9 year old will say hoot because the horn goes hoot and they think it's the word is a hoot. They really like the word, the hoot. You know, only owls hoot. But they like the fact that cars go hoot if they have a horn and bells, bicycles don't because they have bells and bells go ding ding. And I don't understand the logic of that, but it makes some sense. It's just not a right answer. Four? Why would a kid tell me four? Four wheels on the car. Every kid knows that a bicycle has two. That's what bi means. And the car has four wheels. And so four is the right answer because it defines, again, the difference between the car and the bicycle. What is the problem? The problem is to find the relationship that is the same on both sides of the equation. The problem that 8 and 9 year olds and sometimes 10, 11, 12 year olds have, and depending on the content, 15, 16, 20 year olds have, is losing track of the fact that the problem is to identify the relationship that is the same. And it's a very simple kind of problem, but it says, on one side, we have the bell and the bicycle, and kids know a lot about both of those. And on the other side, we have something and car, and kids know a lot about those. How do they get that knowledge? Toys. Sensory motor experience. They see bicycles. They see cars. They see engines in cars. They count to four. So they have the sensory motor knowledge. What if this word were funicular? How many of you know what a funicular is in the first place? Okay, I'm on safe grounds. Exist, it's a real word. It refers to something. If you haven't had the experience with it, you don't have a clue. So if I put those five up there, you can't do the problem. You have no sensory motor experience with a funicular. So you can't do it. You have to have the experience to know what the object is, what it's referring to, then you have to have the language to represent it. So you have to know what the words refer to in your sensory motor experience. So you've got the sensory motor experience down here. Remember the Piaget stack. And then you've got the words. And then you have the relationships. And this is the concrete operational part. Bells are related to bicycles, but the relationship is not provided in the problem. You have to generate that relationship from your experience of how bells and bicycles might be related. How many of you have had a bicycle with a bell? How many of you have had a bicycle without a bell? You can't do the problem because you don't know that bicycles have bells, right? How many of you have a bell that works? Right. How long did your bell work if you had one? Like about a month, right? Then the little dingy thingy gets bent and it rusts, or it's made out of plastic and it breaks. So, in fact, bicycles don't have bells. They could have, but they don't. But kids know that bicycles could have bells. They know that cars have engines. They know that cars have horns if they're registerable. And you generate from your experience, from your store of knowledge, the possible relationships. How many of you thought about the fact that bell and bicycle start with the same letter? B. So you looked over here and looked for a word that had a C and there weren't any, so you threw away that hypothesis. Because starting with the same letter is not matched by any of the possibilities over here. What you're doing when you answer this question is thinking of, and this is the concrete operational part, thinking of possible relationships between bells and bicycle, and then thinking about the whole range of possible relationships here between these five words and car. And you're sorting through them. The kids who tell me that engine is the right answer don't have an appropriate sorting strategy. They can generate, okay, bicycles have bells, bicycles don't have engines, cars do have engines, therefore, engine is the right answer. Problem is that an analogy requires formal operational thinking in this case. What you're doing is taking the possible relationships that you've generated here and the possible relationships that you've generated here, and the task is to compare them. Compare them. And the challenge is to find two that are the same. What does that take? You have to have the experience. Can't be a question about a funicular. You have to have the language. You have to have the concrete operations organized enough so that you can generate the relationships. And then the biggie. You have to keep those relationships that you've generated in mind. You've got to hang on to them and sort through them. And they're not presented. They're mental operations. You have to generate the possibilities. Keep them in mind and sort through them to figure out which ones are the same. This is an abstract relationship because it's not about the relationship between these two or these two. That's a concrete relationship, and there are several of them that are possible. But the next step that is required to answer the question is to take this relationship and this relationship and say they're the same, even though they're not the same. Okay? Because if you're listening to horns on a car, how do they sound? Ooga, or you know, whatever. And I'm rollerblading down the bike path, and the bicycle sneaks up behind me and it goes ding ding. And I jump out of my boots and fall over. And so I got ooga and ding ding. Sensory motorily, they're not the same at all. They're not the same. They're not generated the same way. They're not auditorily the same. But they are devices on their respective vehicles that are used for warning dumb rollerbladers that are in the middle of the path or the street. That's an abstract identity. And the kid has to sort through and say, well, they're different. The content is quite different, but they have the same purpose. So we say that these two relationships have the same form. We call them isomorphic. Iso meaning same, morphic meaning shape or form. And isomorphism is a crucial characteristic of schemas. Whether it's a sensory motor schema, that you have two ways of doing something, or you do in one case, you roll the chalk this way, and you roll a marble with the same motion, those are isomorphic patterns, sensory motor schemas. Words sometimes are isomorphic, they're synonyms. Relationships can be isomorphic. And in this particular case, they're isomorphic. You have a whatever it is as a warning device on a whatever it is. What that sentence is, and you were taught to generate a sentence so you can describe and apply it on both sides. What that sentence is, the bell is a warning device on a bicycle. The horn is a warning device on the car. I should put auditory in there because it's specific. It's not a signal light. Okay. This is a form. This is a scheme. And it's a scheme that transcends the content of all of the examples, and you have two examples. And the kid has to generate that form. The person, the adult, teenager, has to generate that scheme to get this problem right. That scheme is not presented in the problem. That scheme comes from the kid's own experience. And the scheme has to apply on both sides. But he's creating a form. It means it has the same form. And we use, in Piaget's term, formal operations, mental operations, because they are about the form, not the content. The concrete operational kid uses mental operations to generate the relationships. But the formal operations are about the shape of the relationships and whether they're the same, rather than being about the content. A bell is not identical to a horn. A car is not identical to a bicycle. They're different content. But the form of the relationship that we're asking the kid to pay attention to is the same. I've generated a form. How many times a week do you fill out forms? You fill out a form, right? An application is a form. A request to withdraw from HDFS-5. They give you a form. They give you a form. What is that? A form is a representation of a series of relationships among information. The information will be unique to each person who fills out the form. You each have a unique ID. You each have a unique name. Well, most of you do. You have a unique advisor, a unique reason to withdraw. So you put your specific content, your identity, into the form. The form applies to everybody, so it's general. We've done the same thing. I've created a form. The bell is an auditory warning device on a bicycle. The horn is an auditory warning device on a car. What if I said ambulance? Siren. What if I said fire engine? What if I said steamship? Whoop. One of those, right? Okay. What if I said garbage truck backing up? What is it? Five 5:30 in the morning. Okay, you've got the context for that. See, you can generate a relationship between the garbage truck backing up and you're being asleep. Right? You can generate your sensory motor experience of the garbage truck backing up. Right? What does it sound like? How many of you can generate the word? Not a single one of you knows the word. No car and truck accessory catalog buffs in here. Right? You don't know the word for that auditory warning device, which is specific to construction and truck and other vehicles backing up. There is a word, but you can think about the problem. Okay? So whatever it is that goes, is an auditory warning device on a backing up garbage truck. Challenge, find the word. Airplane. Airplanes don't have auditory warning devices for pedestrians. They don't need them. If you're out on the runway and get run over by an airplane, you know, too bad. The sound itself of an approaching airplane, they tell me, will be loud enough that you will know. It doesn't have an auditory warning device. What you're doing, and this is a very important grown-up skill, is you're taking a form and you're applying it to new content and you're generating the appropriate relationship to the extent that you can. If you don't know the word, you can't. You can give me the sensory motor answer, being but you can't do the word. But if I had five words up there that might apply, if I had the right word, you could probably pick out, you'd recognize that you probably have heard that word before. You just didn't know that's what that device was called. Okay? I'm going to argue that most of the items that you have on that quiz, in order to answer fully, at least the first three, are all examples of needing to find an abstract isomorphic relationship. And the reason that we do not get correct performance on most of those items until kids get to be adolescents is that they can't do that particular part. They may know lots of things at the sensory motor level. They may know the words. They may be able to generate relationships. But this next piece, taking the relationships they've thought of and comparing them to see if they're isomorphic, that escapes them. Okay? Let's see if we've got examples. Knowledge is to drink, book learning, teacher curiosity as water is to thirst. What did you put? That was unanimous, right? How many of you didn't have curiosity? It's okay. What did you have? Learning. Why? What was your thinking as you went through it? They may be wrong. So don't. I know I can put you on the spot. Okay. Yeah. Yeah? Okay, so you're in the right ballpark of the relationships. You quench your thirst by drinking water. It fell apart. when you try to find the parallel or equal relationship on the other side.
You could say that when you're learning, you're getting knowledge.
Yeah.
When you want to learn, you get knowledge, and when you're thirsty, you get water.
Yeah. So when you're thirsty, that's a state, a drive state, we call it in psychology. You know, we make the rats thirsty so they will be motivated to go after the water, which they will get by pressing the bar, right? So it's a drive state, and it contributes to learning. So when you're thirsty, you seek water, and that will satisfy you. And among the other five, which one is a parallel drive state? Curiosity. Curiosity is wanting to know something. It's a drive state, and knowledge will satisfy that. So those of you who said curiosity are right, but you can see the analysis that you have to go through generating those relationships to determine which ones are actually right. What about the next one? Leather is to, this one's harder because you have two different positions, so you have many more potential answers, potential relationships. How many of you, what did you say?
Shoe and clay?
Who said something different? Explain. Shoe and house?
I said shoe and house.
Shoe and house, okay. Hide and clay? Hide and clay? Okay. So, tell me about, what was the first one? Shoe and clay? Yeah. Tell me about shoe and clay. Okay, so leather gets turned into a shoe, clay gets turned into a brick. Okay, so hide is converted to leather by tanning, and clay is converted to brick by firing, molding and firing. What's the problem? They are in opposite directions. Now, some of you missed 5 points on the SATs because nobody told you that the convention, only a convention, we all agree, those of us who make up and score the test, that they have to go in the same direction, left to right or right to left. Although humans prefer symmetry that is bilateral. Humans prefer and think something is more beautiful if it goes from inside to outside or outside to inside. Those are opposites. So although it is in fact the better analogy because it's based on going from raw material through a formative process to an intermediate material, it's wrong. Rats! It's wrong. You can make a case for, what was the other one? Hide and house? Clay and house. What was the other one? Hide and house? Because hide is made into leather and bricks are made into house. Sometimes. So you can make that argument. Except that the house is a finished product, leather is not. So, you can argue this one. Lunzer says it's leather shoe, clay brick. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But you can see the process that you have to go through in generating the possibilities. And in this case, understanding the manufacturing process or the transformative process that goes from hide to leather to shoe and clay to brick to house. Those are clearly sort of equivalent, but the way the problem is set up, it screws them up. So you have to pick something that is less satisfying to keep the analogy going from left to right, or right to left, whichever way you want to talk about it. Okay. Now, how many of you have ever taken the Miller analogy test? Go to graduate school at the University of Minnesota in psychology, and they will subject you to this wonderful test. I hope they still do it. Miller is a faculty member at Minnesota in psychology, and he's an expert on analogies and the kind of thinking that psychologists learn to do in graduate school. So he made up a test, several forms, 100 items. And they start with ones like our first one, and then they go to words in two positions. And by the time you get to the end, you have 5 choices in each of 4 places. Right. It's timed. It's timed. I got through it. I answered every item. And I missed a few. And one of them I missed. I will always remember some of what was in it because the words included bucolic, buckle, pastoral, pastor, pasture, pastoral, I know I missed that one. And one of the things that got me was that I don't have a clue what that word meant. I didn't have a clue what that word meant. How many of you know what buckle means? B-U-C-C-A-L. I feel better. You don't know either. Okay. You all have. It's an adjective. And in your mouth, you have teeth. And each tooth, we used to have dental hygiene on campus, and they took this course, and so somebody always knew. Because each tooth has a buccal surface and a lingual surface. Tooth. Okay. Buccal surface, lingual surface. Got a clue? Tongue. Cheek. The buccal surface is the cheek side of your tooth. And the lingual surface is the other side next to your tongue. Okay. This is useful knowledge. You will use that next time you go to the dentist. And you can... Dentist will say, you have a cavity. And you can say, is it on the buccal surface or the lingual? Oh, wow. Okay. Nothing like a little vocabulary. Okay. Next example, number relationships. You all love this one. Right? Put in the blank the number that best completes each series. Okay? How many of you looked at this, got anxious, panicked, and did not do it? Be honest. Okay. Math phobia and poor self-concept in math will make you do that. And I could go off on schools and teaching of math, but I'm not going to. But let me just say that people who are math phobic have usually had bad experiences in math. And one of the bad experiences can be described as excessive disequilibrium. Remember disequilibrium? It's what happens when you're put in a situation where what you're expected to know or what you need to know or the problem you're facing does not match what you do know. And the way you know the world doesn't help you understand what you're exposed to. That leads to the feeling of disequilibrium, which is at low levels will make you curious, well, what do I need to know? How do I need to accommodate the experience that I'm having? How do I need to change my knowing to deal with this situation? And once you change your knowing, you get the information that you need, your disequilibrium is resolved and you're back to equilibrium, you understand the world and you get an A in math. The problem with disequilibrium is that when it gets too big, people get anxious. They don't know how to get the information they need. They're overwhelmed by the situation, and they bail. They run. They cry. They go to sleep. Anything. They avoid the situation. The problem is that in math, many people don't have the knowledge that they need to address the problems. And often, this is my soapbox, often the problem is they don't have the sensory motor experience and the words to describe it that are necessary for being arithmetic or mathematical. And then they get into school where they're expected to know this stuff and they fail. And they don't like failing. Failing creates a lot of disequilibrium and it gets worse and worse as they go on and they become math phobics. Right? Describe some of you. So you see numbers and if it's not a telephone number, you bail. These are not telephone numbers. They're examples of generating a relationship and then generating an isomorphic example. Same form. So what did you get in A? How'd you get that? There's squares. 8 times 8 is 64. 5 times 5 is 25. 3 times 9. You don't have to know about squares to do it. It's just multiplication. And you don't have to know multiplication to do it. You just add it. 8 plus 8, 8 times is 64. 3 plus 3 plus 3 is 9. 4 plus 4 plus 4 plus 4. Okay, so a number added the same number of times that it is gets you the answer. So you have three examples in this case, and what you're doing is finding the common form, the isomorphic relationship. Even though the numbers are all different, you see the operation or the isomorphic relationship, and then you just apply it. Right? So it's the same kind of thing, except that instead of having one example, as you do in the analogies, you have three, and you get to figure out what the isomorphic relationship is. And that's actually easier than the analogies problem, because it's constrained. There are only a certain number of relationships. How about B?
2.5.
Okay. So it's the number on the left doubled plus 1. So, but you have to go backwards. So 8 minus 1 cut in half is 3.5. 2.5. I'm sorry. 6. I got up. I don't know where I got the 8. I made that up. 6 minus 1 is 5. Cut in half is 2.5. Okay, so you can get the others. D is real simple, just doubling. And you can apply the relationship again over and over and over again because what you have is a form. And you could take, for example, I was just curious. Okay. So, in this case, I am doubling each time. So what if I had another blank there? 8. What's there? 16. What would be there? And the next one? And? 1024, 2048, 4096, I'm done. Okay. What if I had a blank there? Negative 1, I'm doubling. 0.5, half. Two halves is 1. Okay. These are all the same except that this one's quadrupling. So again, 256 quadrupled would be... Right. You just said that. Right? 1024. You knew that. Okay. What about this one? What'd you get in the two blanks in F? 18 and 16. How come? Okay. The difference is 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Thirty to 25 is 5 point different, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? 5. Okay. So plus 0, plus 1, plus 2, plus 3, plus 4, plus 5. What would this one be? 36, 43. Ah, so this one is a little bit different. And this one illustrates a point about one of the things that happens as kids become formal operational thinkers. Concrete operational thinkers will be able to do this one because it's a simple one. What you're doing is taking the series and what would the next number